Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. We come to chapter 7, the fourth exit point from the cycle. It begins with a quotation from the Dhammacakka Sutta. This, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of dukkha. Only this noble eightfold path, namely, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. This is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of dukkha. And this way leading to the cessation of dukkha is to be developed. The first three exit points that have been addressed so far each relate to a different portion of the cycle of dependent origination, the wheel of birth and death. The first exit point is at dukkha, this being link number 12. The second exit point is the bridge between feeling and craving, these being links number 7 and number 8. The third exit point relates to the establishment of vijja, awakened awareness, and the non-arising of avijja, ignorance, unawareness. It is thus associated with link number 1, or just before link number 1. It has been noted along the way how these three exit points relate to the first, second, and third noble truths. Also, the reader might have noticed that each of these is operating at an earlier point in the sequence of the cycle. It can thus be considered, is there then a fourth exit point associated with the fourth noble truth? If so, where would that be on the cycle? If it's a pattern that each one happens earlier in the process, how could you go back before link number 1? This chapter will explore this area and this possibility. Having said that, please note, gentle reader, or listener, gentle listeners, that just as with the other exit points from the cycle described here, this is not presented as a definitive way of interpreting the process of dependent origination and cessation. Rather, it's just one pattern of reflective inquiry, investigated and teased out, in order to help actualize the cessation of dukkha, that is the purpose of the entire teaching of the Buddha. So once again, this is just a sort of particular reflections or ways of putting things together that have taken shape in my mind. And so also just labeling, you know, the certain exit points as sort of number 1, number 2, number 3, number 4, that they could have been taken in a different order. So it's just that was the ordered itself in that way in a convenient pattern in my own mind, and also it just seemed to be a natural fit. And it was actually, the sources for most of the material in this book came from about 5 different retreats on the theme of dependent origination. One that was in the south of France, I mentioned, and then about three, one here at Amravati, and then one, about 3 or 4 up in Chiang Mai, in a little place where we would hold retreats up in the Chiang Mai area. So it was, and the most recent of these was the one in France, and it was there when I was with the group in Provence, and was talking about exit point 1, 2, and 3, and then it occurred to me that there I hadn't really put it together that they were associated with the noble truths and the way of working with the Four Noble Truths. And it was there when I was sitting in this meditation hall in this, it's actually a former Christian monastery, a Catholic monastery. So sitting in this the big chapel of ex-Catholic monastery, and then that exact train of thought crossed my mind. Oh, well, those three exit points seem to be associated with the first three of the Four Noble Truths. I wonder if there's a fourth exit point, and how would that be connected to the fourth truth? So my mind was sort of exploring things in that way. Also, when you're being translated, you have these long pauses where you say something and then it's being translated into French. So you have these sort of natural reflective pauses. You say something and then as the translator is putting it into their own language, you go, So I wonder how that works, or I wonder what, I wonder if there's a different way of approaching that. So just in the teaching process, there was a lot more that kind of pausing and reflecting along the way. So again, this isn't some sort of classical definitive way of interpreting it, but just a useful pattern that occurred to me at that time. And then since then, I thought when I use that, particularly talking about the fourth exit point and these principles, I felt, well, this is a useful way of talking about it. And so I was inclined to develop that. So since that time, I've used the same format in talking about dependent origination and cessation several times since then, which was now about 3 years ago. Also, but if you're interested, this is the pictures I use for the inside of the front and back covers. That's one of the trees in the garden outside the monastery in Provence in the springtime. So it gives you a sense of the bright green and the blue sky, bright green of the fresh young leaves and the bright blue sky of the south of France. So the next section is called Good Friends on the Path. But any questions or thoughts before I go into that? Okay. It is natural to consider how to maintain the skills and insights derived from the contemplation of and insight into dependent origination in every kind of environment. How do we sustain Dhamma practice in an active, engaging and colourful world? A central feature of solitude or being in a retreat situation is that we refrain from conversation. Therefore, we're able to be more aware of our inner world and the flow of experiences, thoughts, moods and perceptions. Also, particularly if you're in a retreat, you have to do a minimum of decision making. There's a routine that you don't have you don't decide on. It's just that's the routine, that's what you follow. You're not talking to anybody. You don't have to do much in the way of decision making. There's a set pattern of conduct, so it's extremely simple and a very, very plain environment. And also everyone's living according to the precepts, so that the not only are people not speaking, but there's a high standard of respectful, polite relationship between people. Outside of a retreat situation and in the world at large, then as we know, it's not like that. And it's a much more colourful and mobile and engaging situation with a lot more emotional pulls. When we are in an environment where we have to talk to other people, have to perform as a human, where we have an active personality, a life, a name, an occupation, when we are engaging with other people and taking up responsibility and decision-making, receiving the expectation and the needs of the world, that is to say 99% of most of our waking lives, the mind is very easily and naturally drawn into those activities. The world requires us to create the past and the future, to remember our commitments and to make sensible plans and have all kinds of opinions in the present moment. So, how do we sustain attention on the reality of the present? How do we not get lost in those creations of the remembered past or the imagined future? How do we avoid being drawn into created abstractions about the present that the mind is so easily pulled into? So also remembering that performing as a person, I think a little while ago I was pointing out that the word person comes from the Latin persona, which means a mask. Per means through, sona is sound. So it's the mask that actors on a Greek or Roman theatre would wear, that was part of the acting process. So our word person in English comes from persona, so it's literally putting on a mask to meet the world, to perform as your personality, your role in your family, in your work, in the life on the street. So we put on our personae. There are many different things that affect our lives. One of them is relationships, who we choose to spend our time with, because that has an effect. If we've chosen to spend a week together with people who like to meditate, who are not concerned about looking attractive all the time, people who don't need to be entertained or charmed by us, people who can deal with discomfort without complaining, that will likely have a relaxing effect on the mind. If we've chosen to spend a week together with people who like to go to boxing matches, on pub crawls, to royal receptions, or to glamorous film festivals, there'll be a different kind of an effect. The Cannes Film Festival is a couple of hundred kilometers away from the retreat center. So there'll be a different kind of an effect. We will have been caught up in the excitement of the fights, wondering where we lost our phone, worrying about which earrings to wear, or whether we wore the same suit as last time. I'm not saying that sports and pubs, royal events and film festivals are all intrinsically bad things, but how we choose to spend our time and who we spend it with has an effect on our mind and on our heart. There is a teaching of the Buddha called the Highest Blessings, the Mangala Sutta, which is found that we chanted here, both in the English and the Pali, and it's from the Sutta Nipata. In the Buddha's time, the word Mangala meant a lucky charm or a protective spell or a blessing or an auspicious sign. So such things were not just seen as a spiritual blessing, but also means of personal protection. In this discourse, it starts with a deva coming to meet the Buddha. She asks the Buddha, what are the highest blessings, the best sources of protection? The Buddha gives a list of 38 things. Every single one of them is about what you do. There's nothing whatsoever about amulets or magical tattoos or sacred objects. It's all about the choices that we make. Number one on the list of the sources of blessing is not to associate with fools, but to associate with the wise. This is the highest blessing. Asevana chabalanang panditanang chasevana. That's the way that begins. So that's one of these many instances where somebody asks the Buddha a question and he takes the theme and then approaches it, responds to it from a slightly different angle. So very frequently it would be Venerable Ananda asking a question, and then the Buddha would sort of pick it up and then say, well, you can look at it like this. But so this is one of those situations where it seems that this deva came along and said, you know, what are the best kinds of protection? What are the most sort of powerful magical spells? I'm reading into it, but it's so usually that's what a mangala would be, some kind of lucky charm or some kind of protective magical spell that could be cast to bring about some sort of fortunate result. And the Buddha ignores that kind of a mangala altogether and says what the real blessings are, and then these that we recite the highest blessings. It's all about the choices that we make and the way that we live, the priorities that we make in our lives. That said, you might think, well, I'd love to not associate with fools, but that's my job, Ajahn, or you haven't met my family. And those are actual quotations. So I presented this a few times, and both in this country and in other places, in India, I was giving a week of teachings up in Himachal Pradesh at Deer Park Center and different places, and I say, all very well, Ajahn, but some of us don't have choices. What I would say on that is, even if you have got very difficult people in the workplace, you know, in the family or in the kitchen or the office or wherever, there's still there are choices that we make in who we draw close to or how much weight we give to the contact that we have. You know, maybe you do have a sister or a brother. There's a problematic presence that is challenging to work with, but there's different ways that we can kind of quote unquote associate with others, and to not associate can also mean even though you're in the physical presence or you have to work with somebody, a difficult person in the school or the office or in the monastery or in the family, but To not associate also means not carrying that person around in your mind, to not be ruminating or thinking about that person and how, if only he was like this, if she was just like that, or what am I going to say to him, or why does she always do that? You know, we create each other in our minds, and we easily carry each other around. People that we are in conflict with, or people that we're obsessed with or infatuated with, we create each other and carry others around in the mind. So the not associating with fools, I would suggest, it doesn't just refer to the sort of physically keeping company, but it's also how we carry people around in our minds, and that the weight that we give to a particular connection, or the degree to which we allow ourselves to be upset or anxious or excited about the company of another, there's different ways that we can, the attitude that we bring to any kind of connection is part of it. So even if we are by necessity close to some quote-unquote foolish person or challenging person, the way that is handled is on our side. We're not just victims of situations, but we can work with those things internally in terms of our attitude as well. Any thoughts, questions? Nobody has had to deal with associating with fools. Trying to find some wise people to associate with. Yes, Lindsay. Yes.
To think about the original nature we've discussed before. So if the original nature is the same and shared by all the beings, then the way we communicate should be a certain channel, right?
Should is a very loaded word, because the conditioning of how beings manifest and how they communicate and what their habits are is enormously varied. So ideally, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with infinite kindness we relate to all beings. some beings are easier to relate to like that than others, because of the conditioning of behavior and conduct and so on and so forth. So in that we learn those teachings and recite those teachings to set a standard, but we have to work with the patterns of experience as they arise, moment by moment, day by day.
Somehow it's difficult for us to really find the unconditional compassion for people, because even the metaphor we can use in the sutra is like a mother care about her only son, and that is a social condition, a moral condition, and it is also limited.
Yeah, well, the imagery is there in the sutta, but it's also, particularly with loving kindness, the principle that Lumpur Sumedho would almost always outline is we're not trying to make ourselves like everything, but we can train the heart to not hate even that which is not likable. We don't have to dwell in aversion. So many, many years ago, 40 years ago, he started translating as metta, as not dwelling in aversion. So we can be kind to even things that are not likable. We don't have to be unkind. That we can do with no hypocrisy, you're not sugaring anything over. We don't have to be unkind. We can refuse to hate even something which is not likable, which is, and by refusing to hate or to contend against, it doesn't mean that you approve of their actions. What they're doing or the way they are is not likable. You're not condoning what they do, but you are refusing to add to the negativity and contention by hating. So we can be, and I felt that was a very, very helpful way to talk about it. So, and from years ago, that Lumpo Sumato realized that we mistake loving for liking, and that just to take a principle that we can be kind even to things within ourselves, or you know, psychological states within ourselves, or qualities of other beings, we can be kind towards that which is not likable, and that kindness doesn't have to manifest as say supporting what that person does, or giving a somebody what they're asking for. That when a child says, "I want ice cream for breakfast," it's not an act of kindness to say, "Yes, how much would you like?" You can be kind by saying, "No, that's not. It's not. You can't have ice cream for breakfast." So kindness doesn't always mean going along with a particular opinion or desire or a mode of action. I often give the example of this woman who was helping to protect the forest in Northern California, Julia Butterfly. And she climbed up into this redwood tree and stayed up there for 2 years, didn't put foot on the ground for 2 years. And she was up there in the middle of summer and winter through big sort of storms off the Pacific and all kinds of stuff. It was interesting that she was part of a group called Earth First that launched the protest. Some of the people in Earth First wanted her to denounce the logging company and sort of to speak up against the owner of this Maxim Corporation, Mr. Hurwitz. And she wouldn't go along with cultivating hatred and aversion towards him. And so some of the Earth First people were quite upset with her. It's like, you're our torchbearer, you've got to speak up against this guy. And she said, I oppose him cutting the trees down, but I refuse to hate him. And that, and her refusal to support hatred that kind of negativity towards him and his company was seemingly that was the thing that actually helped the forest to be preserved. That was a kind of the deciding feature. Was they got far more support, that she was just this, yes, I'm up this tree, yes, I love you completely, and no, I'm not coming down until you agree to not cut this tree and this whole huge exclusion protection zone around that area of old growth redwoods. So yes, I love you completely, and no, I'm not coming down until you sign the legal agreement. And there was a wonderful photograph after he agreed and the company protected that forest. The two of them meeting on the ground. She came down eventually after 2 years. And he's in his sort of business suit. And she's this kind of hippie, bright-eyed hippie woman. And she's reaching out to his chest, sort of holding her hand up against his heart. And he's got this look on his face like, I don't really know what to do with this. It's kind of weird, but it's kind of all right. And his face was like sort of slightly pleased, slightly confused, and slightly out of his depth. But yeah, she was just that's what she was relating to, and that's what helped to protect the forest. So that there are many, many challenges in our lives, and so it's really mindfulness and wisdom that is the guiding force of how to relate, how to exercise kindness and compassion, and that sometimes it is to get in the way, stand in the way and say, no, I refuse to hate you, but no, I'm not getting out of the way. Yeah. And that takes a lot of mindfulness and wisdom to do that. So far, in the effort to focus on practical applications of dependent origination, there has been an emphasis on the exit points from the cycles of addiction and rebirth. It has been described how three exit points relate to the first, second, and third noble truths. I would suggest there is indeed an exit point related to the fourth noble truth. This fourth truth is the Noble Eightfold Path. This is the medicine that brings about the cure for the spiritual malaise of dukkha. As you might expect, the Buddha gave instruction on how to work with this noble truth too. He named the task for the fourth noble truth, the path that leads to the cessation of dukkha, as it is to be developed, cultivated, brought to fruition. Idang dukkha nirodha gamini patipada aryasacang paveta banti. So that means it should be developed. He also defined that path in the same discourse simply as the middle way, Majjhima Patipada. How then does that fourth noble truth and the means to work with it relate to exit points from the cycles of addiction and birth and death? The Noble Eightfold Path is all about our intentions and our choices. It's about how we work and act internally and externally, the attitude of our mind, what we say and do, and who we choose to be with. So for those of you who are not totally familiar with the Eightfold Path, it's there at the beginning of the chapter. So, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So some internal aspects, some external aspects of that. If we intend to not allow ignorance to arise, as per the third exit point, then we need to see what gives ignorance its strength and to work to deprive it of that fuel. A fire will go out if there's nothing left to burn. Thus, the fourth exit point is talking about depriving ignorance of its fuel, not giving ignorance, unmindfulness, any support. It's a question of removing the fuel from the vehicles of ignorance, not providing that army with nutriment and the means to operate. There's a teaching in the Numerical Discourses, Book of the Tens, Sutta number 61. So you remember the one with the tree that I was talking about yesterday? As Book of the Tens, Sutta 58. Well, this is three suttas on. This is number 61, and I'll refer to it in here in a minute. Where the Buddha talks about the causes of ignorance. He starts off by reflecting, what is the nutriment? What is the supportive condition for ignorance? He then names the five hindrances, the nivarana, as the nutriment, the support for ignorance, the fuel for ignorance. The five hindrances are sense desire, ill will, dullness and sleepiness, restlessness and skeptical doubt. So karma raga, bhyapada, tinamita, udaccha kukuccha, and vichikicca. The Buddha then reflects on what is the immediate nutriment of the five hindrances. He defines the fuel for the five hindrances as, quote, the three kinds of misconduct, unquote. That is, misconduct in body, speech, or mind. The Buddha then reflects on the nutriment for these three kinds of misconduct. He says that the fuel for these three kinds of misconduct is, quote, a lack of sense restraint, indriya samvara. This means being careless and indulgent in sense activity, in what we look at, listen to, taste, smell, and touch, being reactive rather than responsive. So the terminology like that, sense restraint, is a bit of an unusual term in English, at least. I think yesterday I was talking about the difference between reacting and responding, and so it's exactly that. So when there's a lack of sense restraint is, if you like something, you'll chase after it. If you dislike something, you'll try and get rid of it or oppose it. So there's no space for reflection and consideration. So the mind is reactive. Sense restraint doesn't just mean not acting on an impulse by will, but it's in a sense learning to be more responsive to situations, more responsive. There's a bit of space around liking and disliking, comfort and discomfort. And so there's that. I think a helpful way of looking at that, of indriya samvara, or the lack of indriya samvara, is to be when the mind is reactive rather than responsive, then that is something that fuels this whole process of ignorance. Then what is the nutriment? What is the fuel for being unrestrained in the senses? That is named as lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension, sati sampajanya. What, in turn, is the nutriment? What is the fuel for the lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension? It is unwise attention, not using wise reflection, which is yoniso manasikara, attending to things unwisely, like the things that we look at, listen to, you know, eat, smell, taste, touch, not using wise reflection in relationship to the world around us or within us. What is the nutriment? What is the fuel for unwise attention or putting the mind onto unhelpful or confusing things? This is defined as being the lack of faith, santha. What is the fuel? What then is the nutriment for lack of faith? It is, quote, not hearing the good Dhamma, sadhamma savana. And what is the cause? What is the fuel for not hearing the good Dhamma? This, most significantly, is named as not associating with good people. Sapurisa sangseva is associating with good people and not associating with good people, choosing to hang out with foolish people instead. So, that is the root. The origin of this whole causal chain is related to who you choose to spend your time with. Hence, monasteries exist, retreat centers, spiritual groups, meditation groups, and so forth. That's the reason why these kind of places and institutions are seen as valuable. Is one of the reasons is the kind of company that you keep. It's a sort of good behavior club rather than a bad behavior club. So the imagery that the Buddha uses in this to describe that causal chain, again, he's supremely gifted in coming up with helpful and memorable images. So this, again, is Sutta 61 of the Book of the Tens. He's describing how not associating with good persons, becoming full, fills up not hearing the good Dhamma. Not hearing the good Dhamma, becoming full, fills up lack of faith. Lack of faith, becoming full, fills up careless attention. Careless attention, becoming full, fills up lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension. Lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension, becoming full, fills up non-restraint of the sense faculties. Non-restraint of the sense faculties, becoming full, fills up the three kinds of misconduct. The three kinds of misconduct, becoming full, fill up the five hindrances. The five hindrances, becoming full, fill up ignorance. Thus there is nutriment for ignorance, and in this way it becomes full. Just as, when it is raining, and the rain pours down in thick droplets on a mountaintop, the water flows down along the slope and fills the clefts, the gullies and the creeks. These becoming full fill up the pools. These becoming full fill up the lakes. These becoming full fill up the streams. These becoming full fill up the rivers. And these becoming full fill up the great ocean. Thus there is nutriment for the great ocean, and in this way it becomes full. So too, not associated with good persons and so on and so forth. So that's an image that he uses a few times in the teachings, the kind of a natural process. Just as rain falls on the mountain and then it follows in this natural process, this natural chain of causes and effects, that this works with the mind in a similar way, and at the root of it is not associating with good people. Just to continue, the Buddha, being an extremely thorough and scrupulous teacher, then takes us back through the chain in the other direction, and at the conclusion shows what the beneficial results are of making better choices. If you choose to spend time with good people, they will encourage you and support you in listening to good Dhamma, which gives rise to faith, which supports wise reflection, which supports mindfulness and clear comprehension and intuitive awareness, which supports restraint of the senses, which means living responsively rather than reactively and compulsively. This removes the fuel for unwholesomeness in actions of body, speech and mind, which removes the fuel, takes away the support for the five hindrances, which in turn removes the fuel for ignorance. In addition, he points out how wholesomeness in actions of body, speech and mind supports the development of the four foundations of mindfulness. These lead in turn to the fulfillment of the seven factors of enlightenment, and he also describes, in the Satipatthana Sutta, the foundations of mindfulness, and in the Anapanasati Sutta on mindfulness of breathing. And eventually, these lead to true knowledge and liberation. This is all rather a long way of saying, be careful of who you choose to spend your time with. Where we have a choice, who do we draw close to? What do we choose to do together? There are so many choices in the modern world. Who do we communicate with? What company do we choose to work for? Whose Twitter and Instagram accounts do we choose to follow? What television programs do we choose to watch? Which friends do we choose to spend time with? What sites do we visit on the internet? If we are attentive, we see that during the course of a day, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of choices that we make. How do we spend our time? What information do we take in? Who do we choose to be with? All of that has its effect. I'm not encouraging us to be anxious and uptight, but to be discerning. If we choose to spend time with good people, sapurisa sangseva, that sets the conditions in place to support the effort to be awake and to not let ignorance arise. In the absence of ignorance, then vedana, feeling, will not condition tanha, craving, but rather, via concentration, mindfulness and wisdom, as per our Book of the Tens, Sutta 58, our marvelous tree, then vedana, via concentration, mindfulness and wisdom, lead to nibbana instead of to dukkha. This is what I would define as the fourth exit point from the cycle, noble company. So, any thoughts, questions? A lot of words from me there. Yes.
Sometimes it's not so simple just to divide foolish people from wise people. Sometimes you can be speaking to a fairly wise person and say something foolish. So you have to be discerning in yourself and go have your own wisdom to measure it against.
Also seeing the effects of having spent time with such a person, then looking at, okay, what was the result of that? Well, that was really enjoyable, that was really good fun, how do I feel now? I feel good, that was really worthwhile. So looking at the results of the choices that we make is part of that, the development of wisdom, so that in the four bases of success, the Idipada, that fourth one is reviewing, looking back, okay, what was the result of that? And or if you are drawn into someone, the company of someone that you thought was noble company and a wise person, and you realize that you ended up getting tangled up in opinionating about this or getting into some kind of serious argument or a doubt or whatever, and think, well, okay, let's learn from that. That was my, I had a good intention of spending time with that person, but the result has been this. It's been uncomfortable and tangled. Okay, so let's be guided by that. So that you're learning from the choices that you make along the way. There's a famous statement by Alexander Solzhenitsyn in the Gulag Archipelago, in one of his novels about the prison camps in Russia, and he said it would be so convenient if we could just separate the evil out from the good and then just destroy the evil, and all that would be left with the good, or all that we would be left with is the good. Unfortunately, the line between good and evil runs straight through the heart of every human being. A very, very wise comment. So I quoted that quite a number of times over the years. I think it's helpful that the Buddha lays it out like that. And also sort of number one on the list of the Mangalas, in the Mangala Sutta. And also, there's only a couple of places where the Buddha talks about the causes of ignorance. Usually avijja is sort of taken as a starting point. In the Samaditi Sutta, the Sutta on Right View, I think Venerable Sariputta gives that Dhamma talk, and he talks about the outflows, the asava, as the fuel or the source of ignorance. But this one in the Book of the Tens, that's, I believe that's the most extensive sutta on that theme, and it's very rarely spoken about in other places. So the fact you've got that one statement, and it goes through that whole causal chain, and that Sapurisa Sanseva is sort of right at the root of that. It's also the first one on the list of the factors supportive of stream entry, you know, the associating with good people, the four conditions that support stream entry. And then Sadhamma Savana is the second one, listening to good Dhamma is the second one. Yoniso Manasikara is the third one. So they're also not just depriving ignorance of its fuel, but they're also setting the conditions for that quality of profound insight, the stream entry. The fourth one of those four qualities supportive of stream entry is Dhammanudhamma Patipadaya, which means practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma, which is really what the practicing the Eightfold Path free from self-view is, I would say, is the same as practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma, because it's easy for self-view and the habits of eye-making and mind-making to come into the picture when we're trying to practice, trying to meditate, trying to live in a good way. But that practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma is, you're working to train the heart free of conceit, free of eye-making and mind-making. That's the fourth one of that particular list. But it is interesting that those qualities are so they match up with each other. There's first few elements of the causes for ignorance, and the opposite qualities that cause true knowledge and liberation, they match up with those initial qualities supportive of stream entry. Associating with good people, listening to good Dhamma, wise reflection, they're on both lists. Another teaching I thought I might share, because there was a question I think from Deepa. It's Deepa. You're asking about feedback. There's an interesting, again, in the Anguttara Nikaya, there's many, many teachings in this lot. So this is also in the Book of the Tens, Sutta number 44, and it's about giving feedback. It's cast in the form of, first of all, for monastic practice, but you can relate it into lay life as well. So this took place at Kusinara, whether it was close to the time of the Buddha's final passing away or not, but it's in Kusinara, this little village where the Parinibbana took place. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Kusinara in a forest thicket of oblations. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus. Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, those bhikkhus replied. The Blessed One said this, Bhikkhus, a bhikkhu who wishes to reprove, like to give feedback to or to criticize another person, should examine himself with respect to five things and establish five things in himself before he reproves the other person. With respect to what five things should he examine himself? So there's 10 altogether. So there's an initial five and then a second five. Number one, bhikkhus. A bhikkhu who wishes to reprove another should examine himself thus. Is my bodily behavior pure? Do I possess bodily behavior that is pure, flawless, and irreproachable? Does this quality exist in me or not? If the bhikkhu's bodily behavior is not pure, he does not possess bodily behavior that is pure, flawless, and irreproachable, there will be those who say to him, please train yourself first, bodily. There will be those who say this to him. So like, if you want to correct somebody else for their bad behavior, make sure that your behavior is in good shape, first of all. Again, a bhikkhu who wishes to reprove another should examine himself thus. Is my verbal behavior pure? Do I possess verbal behavior that is pure, flawless, and irreproachable? Does that quality exist in me or not? If the bhikkhu's verbal behavior is not pure, and he doesn't possess verbal behavior that is pure, flawless, and irreproachable, there will be those who say to him, please first train yourself verbally. There will be those who say this to him. And again, a bhikkhu who wishes to reprove another should examine himself thus. Have I established a mind of loving kindness without resentment towards my fellow monks? Does this quality exist in me or not? If the bhikkhu has not established a mind of loving kindness without resentment towards his fellow monks, there will be those who say to him, please first establish a mind of loving kindness toward your fellow monks. There will be those who say this to him. So again, along with checking your conduct and say, well, I want to correct someone for the way they talk or the way they've been acting. Okay, what's my speech like? What's my behavior like? And then this third one is, so like I was saying when we're talking about it, do I want you to be different so that I will feel happy? You know, am I irritated with you? Am I coming from a place of like, oh, because she's done it again. I can't believe it. How can she do that? So that's not a heart of loving kindness, I would suggest, but reactivity and aversion. So that establishing a heart of loving kindness is that sense of, well, this person's really making trouble for themselves and causing conflict and difficulty. Maybe I should bring something up so that they'll stop causing themselves and others such harm and cause such problems. The fact that it'll make me feel better is beside the point, but just for mainly for the benefit of the other person and the well-being of the whole situation, then it might be good to raise something for their benefit. So fourth, again, a bhikkhu who wishes to reprove another should examine himself thus. Am I learned? And do I retain and preserve what I have learned? Have I learned much of those teachings that are good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing which proclaim the perfect, complete, and pure spiritual life? Have I retained them in mind, recited them verbally, mentally, and investigated them, and penetrated them well by view? Does this quality exist in me or not? If the bhikkhu is not learned, and so forth, and has not penetrated them well by view, there will be those who say to him, please first learn the heritage. There will be those who say this to him. In other words, do you know what you're talking about? Have you got your, and in a more general sense, have you got your facts straight? That you might say, oh, you know, how could you do that? Or, I heard that this person acted in this way or said that. Do you have the information? Did you check up and see that it actually happened that way? Or are you just acting on hearsay or your own not completely informed perception of things? Fifth, again, a bhikkhu who wishes to reprove another should examine himself thus. Have both patimokkhas been well transmitted to me in detail? That's the rules of the nuns and the rules of the monks. Well analyzed, well mastered, well determined in terms of the rules and their detailed explication. Does there exist in me this quality or not? If both patimokkhas have not been well transmitted to him in detail, in terms of rules and their detailed explication, and if when asked, where did the Blessed One state this? He is unable to reply. Like if you're trying to correct somebody for their breaking the precepts or that their bad conduct, then if you can't say which rule does this person transgressed, where did the Blessed One state this? If he is unable to reply, there will be those who say to him, please first learn the discipline. There will be those who say this to him. So in terms of having your facts straight in terms of Dhamma, in terms of the teachings, in terms of also in terms of Vinaya and the precepts. It is with respect to these five things that he should examine himself. And what are the five things that he should establish in himself? He should consider, I will speak at a proper time, not at an improper time. So you choose a convenient moment. Like if I say, oh, Deepa, could we have a conversation at some point? It's something I'd like to bring up with you. You don't do it in the middle of a Dhamma reading. You have lots of other people around. You put you put your mind onto it and think, okay, what would be a situation where we could speak freely and it wouldn't be intrusive or wouldn't embarrass a person? Or so you speak at the proper time. I will speak truthfully, not falsely, so that you're doing your best to get your facts straight and to speak in accordance with what you know. I will speak gently, not harshly. Again, just choosing your words carefully rather than being accusatory or rude or using sort of aggressive or abusive language. Nine, I will speak in a beneficial way, not in a harmful way, so in a similar spirit, and I will speak with a mind of loving kindness while not harboring hatred. These are the five things that he should establish in himself. Because a bhikkhu who wishes to reprove another person should examine himself with respect to these five things and establish these five things in himself before he reproves the other person. So this could well have been just before the Buddha's final passing away. Like, oh by the way, if any of you want to correct any of your fellow Dhamma farers, then bring this to mind. So, there's not that many teachings given in Kusinara that I'm aware of, and this is one of them. But it's a very handy advice to have living in community, whether you're a monastic or a layperson. Again, it's Sutta number 44 in the Book of the Tens, if you want to look that up. Yeah, make a note. 1044. Yes.
Odds of all of those things being present and aligned are quite slim.
Can we negotiate, is what you mean? Can we negotiate?
Okay, yeah, because according to that, most of us don't have a leg to stand on to reprove. according to the first five, if all five of those need to, usually you're not perfect yourself in speech. Not usually, but as a lay speaking to a lay person, seems to be the case that often you probably won't be ticking all the boxes.
Well, as with many of the teachings, that the Buddha's laying out the standard, like, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Should. And so there's a setting of a standard, that the words are used to clarify the ideal, so you know what to aim at. And I've used these teachings many, many times, and when I was living in California, there was a local yoga center in the nearby town. We would give teachings out once a month, and one of the organizers of that, I remember her saying, so Ajahn, how free of the faults do you have to be before you bring it up? Like, if you know that you should be free of anger before you raise the issue of somebody else's anger management issues with them, you know that you should be, and that's something that you aspire to, but you're not quite in the clear as yet. Yeah. Do you really have to be totally free of anger before you bring it up with another? And so, not being sort of condoning being half-hearted or lazy, but rather, as long as you know that's the aspiration, or that there is that standard, and also you can acknowledge that, and you can say, I realize I'm not totally free of this myself, but the way that you talked to so-and-so this morning, that set off all kinds of alarm bells in me, so if I could bring that up with you, then that, I think it would be good for you to attend to that, because that caused a lot of distress when you spoke that way. So it's an aspiration. It's a clear aspiration, like a Buddha image. This Buddha image has been sitting like that for more than a century. Never gets knee pain. Never has a sore back. Because it's an image, it's not alive, it's an ideal. So, that we take many of the teachings, they're ideals, they set a very clear beautiful and appropriate standard, like a Buddha image. It's an ideal, it's something to work towards, or it evokes certain qualities, but you're not sort of... If the Buddha image makes you feel like I'm unworthy because I have to keep moving and my legs are sore, my legs ache and I can't sit like a Buddha image, like, well, of course you can't, because you're alive. But it still doesn't mean that the image is not useful. It sets a standard. There's a clear goal to aim towards, or a model to be guided by, and then having that model, having that ideal, then it illuminates the things, the areas where you still need to work and things you need to attend to. So it's like a skillful use of idealism. So you have that kind of standard. Okay, this, you should be free of this. You should be totally conversant with the nun's rules, with the monk's rules, and be able to name exactly which rules. Probably most of us would be challenged to say, well, it's that rule with that subclause that we're referring to here. It's like, possibly, but it's clarifying an ideal standard and then using that, relating to that in a skillful way. So it sets a direction, but you're starting from where you are. The ideal is like an informing principle at the edges, but you're starting from where you are. You work with the way the conditions of your mind are. So even if you recognize that you're not completely free of doubt or anger or fear or whatever, then you can acknowledge that. Well, that being the case, and this is there's an effort to work with this, but there's with that in mind and acknowledging that, then to speak from that basis. It's like you're not associating with fools. It's like that kind of empties out my contact list. How many are left on my on my address list? But it's an aspiration, and it's if you can incline away from that, if you can cultivate these qualities, so it's setting a clear direction, and then that it's like a compass reading. You know, it's okay, that gives you a good direction, then you do the best you can to work with that. So we're nearly at 7. So the last bit of this section was just going through those lists. So these are the two parts of the Sutta 61 in the Book of the Tens. What is the nutriment? What is the supportive condition for ignorance? The five hindrances. What is the nutriment for the five hindrances? The three kinds of misconduct. What is the nutriment for the three kinds of misconduct? Lack of sense restraint. What is the nutriment for the lack of sense restraint? A lack of mindfulness and full awareness. What is the nutriment for lack of mindfulness and full awareness? Unwise attention. What is the nutriment for unwise attention? Lack of faith. What is the nutriment for lack of faith? Not hearing good Dhamma. What is the nutriment for not hearing the good Dhamma? Not associating with good people. And in contrast, true knowledge and liberation have a nutriment. What is that? The seven factors of enlightenment. What is the nutriment for the seven factors of enlightenment? The four foundations of mindfulness. What is the nutriment for the four foundations of mindfulness? Three kinds of good conduct. What is the nutriment for the three kinds of good conduct? Sense restraint. What is the nutriment for sense restraint? Mindfulness and full awareness. What is the nutriment for mindfulness and full awareness? Wise attention. What is the nutriment for wise attention? Faith. What is the nutriment for faith? Hearing good Dhamma. What is the nutriment for hearing good Dhamma? Associating with good people. Sapurisa Sangh Seva. So again, that's Book of the Tens, Sutta number 61. So one of the many treasures that we have in the Anguttara. So any final comments, questions, thoughts?
I have one question.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, because sometimes in the contact with the other people, the outer appearance of the person seems to be very nice and quiet. Everything is quite okay. But then the fire and irritation appear within ourselves. Sometimes it takes a really long time to discover where the irritation comes from. Mm-hmm. So, how can we reflect on this? Maybe bring an image of the person?
Or you mean the other person's good behavior makes you irritated?
But there is something very much irritated about this person.
Uh-huh.
So how to... any advice how to work with this? It's happened to me.
Yes, yeah. Probably many of us.
Yes. But it was actually, at the end, it was very good because when I discovered what was the irritation, so actually I was able to work with my, at the end I was working with my inner feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So how to discover what is behind this irritation?
Well, with many things like that, when you notice that coming up, that's just, that's interesting, because part of my mind is very impressed with this person. I think they're, I name them as a good person, but there's this irritated feeling that arises. But just to start off with, oh look, there's this feeling, and then where does this come from? And it might be that the question is there, but there's no intuitive sense. But just to notice that kind of reaction happens, first of all. And just to not feel like you've got to figure it out, but just to know, oh look, when there's that, I'm around that person, this kind of reaction happens. So it's important for us to not be filling in those gaps with an idea or sort of deduction or... to let the unknown be unknown is an important part of Dhamma practice. You can see some kind of reaction happening, but it's not clear where that comes from. And it might be that you need to look at that and see it over and over a number of times before eventually, a few weeks or a few months later, I think it's because of this. Is that right? And then so the mind comes up with some intuitive feeling. Oh, I think it's that, because they are so perfect. They're trying so hard to be this perfect thing. Maybe it's that tryingness. Maybe that's what sets my alarm bells off. I'm just making that up. But it can be, it's this thing. They're trying to perform this role. They're trying to be this pure person, and that tryingness is irritating. Maybe that's it. So then you watch and you go, oh, I think that's right, because actually it's really helpful that they're so polite and kind and generous, but it's this performing of a role that there's there seems to be a lot of self involved in that, and maybe that's what it is. So you kind of explore and test out things as you go along and see how it works. I often mention how right here in the sala, this building is not going to be here for much longer, so you can't, only a limited amount of time you can say this. But it actually was an exchange happened here in this sala back in the late 80s or early 90s. And I'd always tried to be that kind of I wasn't trying to be irritating, but I was I was irritating in trying to do everything right and be the kind of the perfect monk, was sort of an obsession of trying to do everything right and be the best and be sort of super keen and good at everything. And after a time, I got the feeling within myself, this is really missing the point. I'm just sort of trying to act a certain role. It's a lot of me wanting to be this thing. And so I deliberately stopped doing that and just let myself be more average and not trying to be so sort of perfect and helpful and meeting this idea of the perfect monk. And one of my brother monks said to me, you're much more easy to live with since you stopped trying to be perfect. So it was annoying to be with, exactly. And but when I relaxed and just sort of tried to just be more natural and just do things without trying to be something or fit some sort of idea, then that's what he said. And he wasn't accusing or trying to find fault. He just said, it was like a passing remark, you're much easier to live with since you stopped trying to be perfect. Oh. So he had noticed exactly that. But with many things in life, the exact reasons why we feel the way we do about each other, you can't, it's not sensible to try and pin it down too quickly. It's because someone you might feel that you're really happy and you feel really good around that person. And then you can read all sorts of things. Or maybe we were related in a past life. Or this must have been my child or my dad. Or not. You don't have to to create a whole story around it. Or people that just automatically irritate. It's like, I don't know what it is, but that person just annoys me. Well, like, yeah, Lumpo Samedo would talk about this when he was a young monk at Wobbapong. There was another monk there, he just wanted to hit him. And he said, I'm not aggressive. I'm a gentle person. I'm a Buddhist monk. But when I see that monk, I want to hit him. And for a long time, I was like, why do I feel violent or aggressive towards that person? And it took him a long time to exploring that. Why is that reaction happening when I see this person? And so, you know, sometimes it can become clear. But that, in that instance, the way Lumpo Samedo talks about it was long before I showed up. You know, but the way he talks about it, he realized because the body language of that monk was very fearful, he kind of cowered and was always sort of looking afraid. And so Lumpo Samedo realized, oh, he's putting out these fear signals, so it's triggering aggression in me. It's not personal at all. It's some kind of instinctual thing, that like a kind of tribal instinct. If someone is cowering and showing fear, then it brings up aggression. You know, oh, that's really... So he was quite insightful for him. It's like, you know, it's actually not personal at all. It's because that person puts out that signal, it creates this reaction in me. Oh, well, it's anatta. But there was no kind of past life connection or some, you know, clash or problem between them. It was just, oh, that. But it took a while of him looking at that thing. Why do I feel like that? There's nothing wrong with him. Why do I dislike him to the point where I want to hit him? And then he thought, oh, it's just a human sort of tribal instinct, you know, kind of the pack mentality brings that up. And so you could see, okay, that there wasn't anything to any kind of personal issue to work out between them. It's like, because of that behavior, there's this reaction. There's the cause, there's the effect. And he could, by seeing it, he could let go of it. But it took quite some time of seeing that reaction happening and then also choosing not to read too much into it, but just kind of getting to see how it worked. And then one day it just sort of, oh, that's probably it. That's what the trigger is. It's that manner, the body language is having this effect. So leaving things unknown is really useful. Let the unknown be unknown, and then the intuitive process can function, got some space to function. Okay, I think that's enough for today.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.